Hello and welcome to our latest episode of Debt Wired. I'm Dan Angelacci, Senior Credit Reporter at Debt Wired CEMEA, and today I'm joined by Charlie Robertson, Head of Macro Strategy at FIM Partners. Thanks for joining us, Charlie.
Thank you very much for inviting me on. Appreciate it.
In this episode, we will be discussing the recent pressure on African sovereigns, specifically in light of the slew of recent military coups and lagging regional GDP growth. Charlie Robertson's book, The Time Traveling Economist, published in 2022, looks at the impact literacy levels, fertility rates, and electricity supplies have on developing economies. Charlie, let's start with the first theme. To what extent are expectations around increasing fertility rates and the associated slower GDP growth priced in by credit and equity markets, specifically over longer horizons?
I think very badly. The problem is that markets inherently don't like something as long-term as demographics and fertility rates. Something which matters so much over 10 or 20 years doesn't feel relevant on 1, 2, or 3 years. So if you're looking at credit quality of a country like Nigeria, for example, it's all about whether or not the oil price is $100 or $40. And fertility rates feel irrelevant. But that's quite wrong, in my view, because the fertility story is so closely linked to savings and deposits in the banking system. I was just looking at numbers this morning from Vietnam, which I know is in Africa, but bear with me for a second. So Vietnam deposits in the banking system are about 115% of GDP. In Nigeria or Zambia or Ghana, they're around 20. Now, why so low in those countries and so high in Vietnam? Because in Vietnam, 30 years ago, the fertility rate dropped below 3 kids per woman. Why does that matter? Because families that have 2 kids, on average, 2.5 kids, sort of figures we get in Vietnam, they can save money, and they do save money on a Friday night. And when you've got 6 kids, 6.5 kids, as we've seen in Niger, so one of the countries that had a coup recently, no one's got any money to save. On a Friday night, there is no cash. You can barely feed your kids, let alone put money away in the bank. So the bank's got no money. So interest rates in Niger are inherently extremely high. And because they're extremely high, it creates a tendency on the part of governments in high fertility countries to borrow cash from abroad. Because quite often during a cycle, it's cheaper to borrow from abroad than it is at home. And it's been high fertility countries that have been defaulting globally for thousands of years. I think a small Greek island was one of the first defaulters ever, 2,500 years ago. All of Latin America's defaults, except for Venezuela and Argentina, but they are a little bit special. All of Latin America's defaults in the 20th century were in high fertility countries. 90% of all defaults in the second half of the 20th century, globally, 90%. We're in high fertility countries. Now, we've completely lost sight of that message in the last 10, 20 years. Why? Because in the last 10, 20 years, global rates were so low, anyone could borrow as much as they liked. So there really wasn't, I mean, apart from, again, a very few exceptions, Lebanon, Sri Lanka, Argentina, Venezuela, there are very few exceptions. But they became the dominant story. So people have lost sight of what actually drives most defaults globally. So no. To answer your question, that took ages. Sorry, but to answer your question, that it's not something priced in the main or even recognized.
Right. So you mentioned bank deposits and sustainable GDP growth. To what extent are these two useful predictors for coups and in general public distrust with government in African countries?
I'd start with what drives fertility. And all the data shows us it's education. If you have a poorly educated population, particularly women, it really matters with women, then fertility rates are very high. So take a country like, well, in fact, all of the countries in the Sahel, all of them have adult literacy rates of sub 60%. You don't even grow sustainably if you're sub 40%. That's men and women, of course, but you don't even grow. And we're talking literacy in any language. It doesn't have to be English or French. It's any language. So if you've got under 40% adult literacy, that's usually geared towards men, by the way. So that's normally about 60% men, 20% women, say. Women don't have job prospects. not serious job prospects. Very few illiterate people can ever earn any amount of money. And the tendency, the cultural preference in low literacy societies is to have a lot of kids. And having a lot of kids means that, first of all, you've got no savings in the bank. So you're not going to grow fast as an economy. It's impossible to grow fast. In fact, I've did some great data on this. I looked at all the growth rates in all the countries since 1960. And per capita growth is no more than 1.5% when half the population are kids, which young countries like Niger, it's even more than half the population of kids. So you don't grow fast. They've got no savings. There's nothing for investment. There's no jobs. So how can any president stay popular in a country like that? Now, if you're very lucky, like Botswana in the 60s, and you've got like seven people in your country and a lot of diamonds, okay, you can get rich then. But that's not true for the vast majority of countries in Africa. There's this myth that the continent is rich in mineral resources. It does have mineral resources. But when they're split between getting on for 1.5 billion people, they really don't go very far. So what we have is a situation in the Sahel of poorly educated countries, unable to grow fast, no president could be popular. And coups are not a surprise in that environment. They weren't a surprise actually in Latin America when they had high fertility and low literacy in the 20th century. And they were not a surprise in Africa across the continent in the 20th century. And now we're seeing it in the Sahel.
Within this context, are there any countries in particular that we should be more concerned about in the sort of short and midterm? You mentioned the countries in the Sahel, but is it isolated to them, or could it pertain to others?
I mean, the Sahel countries are particularly vulnerable. I got flown out to the US Africa Command headquarters, which is in Germany, as you'd expect Africa Command headquarters to be, to speak to their senior officers, and very bright people, actually, very thoughtful and very good on kind of, they think about the development issues. And I explained that the American army was going to continue to see instability, jihadist-type threats to regimes, coups, and from a financial market perspective, not that they cared, default in low-literacy countries. And since talking to them, we've seen coups in Guinea, in Mali, in Niger, now Gabon, civil war in Sudan, Ethiopia, all countries that fit with this low literacy story. But there are others. I mean, Mozambique had a very poor inheritance from its independence from Portugal, very low literacy rate, and didn't surprise me that it defaulted on the tuna bonds back in the 2010s. That looked extremely likely, I think, all along. It's anyone with literacy that doesn't allow a country to take off. I mean, even some countries globally that do have the education to take off still manage to do a coup or two. You know, Turkey had a failed one in 2016. Thailand has got a higher record of coups than I think any other country in the world. So, you know, there are always countries that, for whatever special reason, are a little bit different. But I guess what I've been concerned about in the last month or so is that it can spread like school suicides. You know, the more of those that go around, they almost become trendy. And I think what's happened on the coup front is that army officers now are saying, well, who's going to stop me? These guys in Mali and Guinea and Niger have got away with it. What's to stop me marching in and overthrowing the president in Gabon? So I am slightly worried that it's becoming a little bit too trendy.
I see. Well, you mentioned Mali, Niger, and Sudan, and last week Gabon suffered a military coup. But the country is distinct in the sense that it currently has Eurobonds outstanding with coupon payments due in November. Do you think there will be a change in tack in how the international community responds to this situation versus others because of this element?
I thought it was possible. But not specifically to do with the case in Gabon, but more as a signal to other countries, militaries in other countries, which could be, you know, when I was talking about this on Twitter, people were suggesting Cameroon or Senegal or Uganda. I mean, all sorts of names were being thrown around. The fear of who could be next. So I did wonder whether the international community might do something about Gabon. But I think there's two things have happened. Firstly, Gabon's president wasn't seen as democratically elected anyway, not like in Niger. And so the impression has been, well, we're swapping one guy who'd been there a long time for somebody else who might be there for a long time. The second thing is that Gabon's leadership has claimed that they will prepare for return to democratic elections, which is the right thing to say. So I think the combination of these two factors means, no, I don't see any threat now that the Gabon's going to be singled out for special treatment.
I see. Thank you. With regards to the, obviously there's in the region, you've got heightened security risks at this point, or at least people perceive them to be so. Do you see these risks affecting the prospects or the timelines of current restructurings, such as Ghana or Zambia, or are they can work independently?
I suspect they will be independent. There's, firstly, you've got a much healthier human capital story in countries like Zambia and Ghana. Ghana has had coups back in the past, back in late 70s, and I think 1981 or so as well, or certainly the early 80s. By the way, when the literacy rate in Ghana was about 40%. Today, it's over 80%. So you're in a completely different kind of socioeconomic situation, which makes it much less likely. And the same for Zambia. Zambia's also got this very high literacy rate. So I think people are not, at the moment, people are saying this is a Francophone issue. And if there's any commonality to the story about why it should be a Francophone issue, it's not to do with the fact that France has too much power or too involved in the economies. I don't think that's true. China's more involved than France in most of these economies. It is, I think, to do with the fact that when France left these colonies in 1960s, the literacy rate was somewhere around 1 to 3%. Well, the Anglophone countries, partly for religious reasons, missionaries used to go off and do their thing, were often left with literacy rates of about 20 to 25%. Ghana, Zambia, southern Nigeria, Kenya, Uganda all have literacy rates up at about 80%, not being caught up in this coup story. So I don't think people will be looking at Ghana or Zambia and worrying about it.
I see. What about other Eurobond issuers such as Benin or Ivory Coast, which have come to market quite recently, actually?
They are not 100% safe, in my view, because first of all, we've got the literacy issue. None of the ones you just mentioned have a literacy rate above 70%. And that's what you need to really take off as an economy for the long term. We've seen Cote d'Ivoire obviously have great many security issues and civil conflict over time. It doesn't look likely to me now, because there's two things I think trigger problems. And one of them is the weak economic growth, which countries like Niger have done. Cote d'Ivoire is in a better place. It has got better literacy than Niger. It's had a very smart president doing the right kind of economic growth story, borrowing, but not borrowing too much, and keeping pretty decent growth coming through to the economy. Is it perfect? No. Is everybody getting a fair grab at the growth cake? No, are they not? But infrastructure is getting built. I wouldn't see Cote d'Ivoire as... It would be low on my list for countries at threat. Benin, I know less well, so I shouldn't speak to that. I was interested by people talking about Cameroon, where you've got a leader who's been there an awfully long time, much like Bongo and his dad in Gabon. And coincidentally, he shifted around a load of his defense personnel just about the day of the coup itself in Gabon. So some people wondered whether that was partly out of his own concern. So. Yeah, no, there are a few issues out there to worry about, potentially.
And do you see his moves being supportive for a coup not taking place?
I'm not enough of an expert on their military setup. I did hear an interesting story about Nigeria, though, some years ago now, which is that Obasanjo, the guy who became president for the first time in the 70s by a military regime, took Nigeria back to civilian rule in the late 70s. Was then out of power for a long time, then came back as a democratically elected president himself in 1999. He could see the risks in Nigeria from coups. So what I heard he did, which is a simplified version of what he did, to make sure it didn't happen again, was he put the army in one city, he put their guns in another city, and he put their ammunition in a third city, so there's no way they could do a coup. Now, I'm sure that's not exactly true, but it worked. 25 years, we haven't had a coup in Nigeria. Or more, actually. So hopefully there are going to be countries that can get through this present trend for these coups untouched.
Thanks, Charlie, for accepting this invite on DebtWired.
Fantastic.
And for discussing key issues around African sovereigns.
Pleasure.
Thanks for listening to DebtWired. Please support the podcast with a like, download, or share through Spotify and iTunes.